Welcome back to Face the Jury, the podcast focused on issues of medical malpractice, how to spot it, how to prevent it, and how to keep you and your family safe. This episode of Face the Jury is brought to you by Forge Consulting, the settlement planning experts. Visit forgeconsulting.com. I'm your host, Lloyd Bell, and today we're returning for more of our conversation with John Campbell, founder of Empirical Jury, to discuss the science of polling, the art of influence, and the melding of big data analytics in jury research. Let's jump back into our conversation where we discussed who exactly the people are that participate in jury surveys and how their opinions become the data points that power a new method of jury research. I'm interested in, I've got a couple questions, and I bet our listeners have these questions too. First of all, where do you get your folks? And how do you get them to meaningfully engage with the story so that you can trust their responses?
Yeah, so you can get the folks from lots of places, but the short answer now is that there are so many platforms that people can go to where they want to do simple tasks. And there are, at any given time, millions of people that are going online looking to do sort of odd job work. I always say it's sort of like, think about Uber as the gig economy. You can drive for Uber when you feel like it. You can drive a little or a lot. There's lots of people doing that online. And there's lots of employers who don't need full-time employees, but they do need somebody to give feedback on copy or to read the chapter of a book or to look at photos of haircuts and sort them and rate them or to do marketing studies. There are academics who need people. And so there is now this economy out there that may be a surprise to some people, but is now pretty robust, in which you can post a job, any job, and say, I'll pay you X amount of dollars. We think it'll take an hour, you know, to do it. And people can choose to do the work. So that's gotten easy. So, you know, if we need 400 or 500 people, we can get them in an afternoon, especially if it's a national sample. And now, anytime you need to, you can target down to the state level and often the city level through these various services. So that's gotten easier. And they've developed all sorts of tools because, of course, companies like to use it, too, for marketing and understanding markets. So if you wanted to, we could give a jury study to only people who drink red wine. It wouldn't be very useful to us, but we can. The level of targeting has gotten really pretty impressive. On the part of how do you get them engaged, part of that is the presentation needs to be clear and easy to understand and good, right? Because you're asking them to work through a case that will never be completely simple. And so part of it is our job is to make sure that that's easy to do. Because unlike an in-person focus group, you know, somebody can't just raise their hand and say, I'm confused, and you clear it up. So you got to really work. Now, what we found is that's a really good process for the lawyers we work with, because making them distill their case into clean, simple ideas with clear headings, with clear arguments, making them write the defense. And then, you know, people get mad at me because I say, no, I need more from the defense. I need more from the defense. I want more from the defense. Let's meet again. Let's talk about it again. But even that exercise is very useful, because how often do we really sit down and boil our case down into a very clean, simple story that a juror could read and understand with some help from images and video?
Well, and that's the feedback I'm getting from some of my close friends and colleagues who've been working with you for a number of months now, is they describe, this one friend in particular I'm thinking of, describes you as sort of a personal trainer for his case, because he imposes the discipline to, as you put it, sit down and think and really work through the defense side. Yeah, it's a piece that doesn't feel as good if you're a plaintiff's lawyer. You know, we want to focus on building our case and presenting our case in the best possible way. It's sort of painful to really spend time with the defense case and contemplate the weaknesses of the plaintiff's case. And it causes anxiety and fear and stress, all those good things. So that process is really interesting. Well, you've been doing this, John, for, I think you said hundreds of cases now. I'm really curious as to what you've learned from interacting with so many sort of focused jurors and what kind of lessons you've learned generally. And then I'd like to hear what you've learned in the age of COVID, how COVID might be impacting our juries.
Yeah.
So can you address those topics?
Sure. Well, a few big takeaways do stand out. I mean, one of them is that I think is surprising to most lawyers, but now we take as just a truth in the office, is that the amount an attorney requests in damages does not simply affect the damages they receive, but could decide whether or not they win the case. When I say that to people, sometimes I see the look in their eye like, well, how can it be that how much I asked for could affect whether I win? But we see that all other things being equal, the amount of money requested and how it's requested does not just affect damages, it affects liability. And I think what's going on is, imagine a juror who's on the fence because the case is tough on liability and they're not quite sure what to do. If they hear a damage request that both in the way it's presented and in the amount seems right and good and fair to them, that may be enough for them to say, without thinking this is happening inside, okay, I'm going with the plaintiff. Everything seems better for the plaintiff. And overall, I think the plaintiff's more likely than not right. On the other hand, if they hear a number that either sounds not thought out or greedy to them, it may very well be enough to tip them that the easiest vote's the defense vote, and then they don't need to do the work. And so we see sometimes dramatic swings in win rate based only on how much an attorney requests, which scares me because many, many of us, including myself, for years, picked that number out of thin air from our gut. You know, we didn't know what else to do. So we said, well, you know, and sometimes while you're sitting in the chair waiting to get up to close, you're probably still picking the number. And what we've seen now is that number is critical to the win rate. And even if you've got a slam dunk case on liability, finding what I call the Goldilocks zone, the not too much, not too little spot where jurors line up and that makes sense to them so that they can all kind of move with you to that request, can make a huge difference in the outcome of a case and its value and result. And I'll just mention one other thing in line with that as we're talking about sort of other truths. You know, there's been this ongoing talk about whether you should put your ECOs in or not, whether you should seek your economic damages, especially if they're low compared to your non-economics. And I can tell you that we've seen a couple cases. There's not a universal truth, but I can tell you it's an important decision. Sean Claggett, we worked with Sean Claggett on a case. He got a great verdict, a $38 million verdict in Vegas a few months ago. And Sean had the right to seek an economic damage request for the mother who'd lost her daughter. And the short story is, the daughter had said, I would buy my mom a home when I get older. And so he could say when she got older, she was going to provide financial support to her mother and seek that eco damage. We tested the case with that in and out. Taking out that one request for economic damages increased the case value by $8 million and increased the win rate. So by asking for less and not overreaching and not sounding a little petty to say the mom lost her daughter, but let's not forget she lost some money from her daughter, changed the entire dynamic of the case. Since we don't have hours, if I were to say one thing that I think probably attorneys need to be thinking about more, it is this fusion effect between damages, how they're treated and how they're requested, and what they do to the strength of your overall case.
Well, I want to drill down on that a little bit more, John. There's so much useful and interesting information in what you just said. First of all, you call them eco damage. You're talking about economic damages, things like past, you know, medical bills, past lost wages. And I think what you're touching on is this concept of anchoring, and that the question is, you know, if you've got a case that you think the overall value of the case might be, you know, north of, you know, say $10 million. And you have economic damages of maybe $200,000. Well, that's a big number. That's a lot of medical bills. But if you're asking for something north of $10 million, is there an anchoring effect if you ask for $200,000? In other words, will the jury sees on that $200,000 number and then start doing multiples of that number and factoring in, stepping off from that number and leading to a much lower result? Is that the concept you're talking about?
I absolutely. I think you can have a low anchor. So yeah, I think, you know, for those who haven't heard a lot about anchoring, if you Google it, for example, it's one of the most robust effects ever studied in social science. And it is that when we're operating in a vacuum and we don't know the answer to a question, if a number is given to us, even a number that's not perfectly related to our question, we tend to use that number as an anchor, a place to start. In damage situations, of course, jurors don't know how to give non-economic damages. They uniformly report that as one of the hardest jobs they have. And so, yeah, if we say $10 million, even if they go back to the jury room and say, Lloyd was nuts asking for $10 million, I would never give $10 million. They still said $10 million and they negotiate off it. And there's an anchoring effect. Of course, if you introduce another number like $200,000, the risk is they start to work off that number too. So, yeah, I think that's part of it. But the other thing, Lloyd, I think that's happening sometimes, and I can't take full credit for this, I was talking to David Ball about this the other day, is you're also putting jurors in a different way of thinking. So if you're fighting over medical bills and the defense is challenging some of the future care and past care, and the jury's going through that line by line now, that's a very different analytical task than thinking about non-economic damages. And I think there's some risk that if the jurors get so detailed like that, that then thinking about non-economics, which by definition can't be categorized in that way, and don't have line items in the same way often, we might not want jurors in that mindset. And then the last thing I'll say about that is sometimes the economic damages are a bit of a reach, right? So sometimes attorneys think, oh, I can pile a little on here, so I'll do the loss of economic support and the household services, which most jurors always go, household services? Like you mean like sweeping the floor, you put a value on that, and now there's a dollar amount? And I think sometimes if jurors start to think that the overall damage picture is being stretched, then what they do is they don't just chastise you on the economics that you might be stretching. They beat you up across the board.
Well, and your credibility as an attorney is the most valuable asset that you bring to the case. And if you do things that can undermine your credibility, then you're damaging your client. It's just no way around it. So to your point about economics, I've seen this in things like life care plans, where you have an economic future life care plan of medical needs that the client will need. And unless that's a significant number, you know, we'll just leave money off the table, you know, or leave it on the table, I guess. And with that same concept, because my experience is that jurors will use the evidence available to them. And like you say, if there's a smaller number, then that will bear on their analysis and their approach to doing the economics. You also made another point I think is really interesting. I think you mentioned you had a conversation with David Ball, of course, you know, the great jury consultant, author out of North Carolina, out of Duke, who's had such an impact on my career with his books on his book on damages and his work with theater. Really a great guy. But anyway, you made the point of sort of divided thinking. Because you're right, if the jury has to scrutinize and analyze and determine economic damages, that's a certain part of their brain. And, you know, it's the math side, maybe, and it's you got to really scrutinize the evidence and they want to get it right. But then you try to get them to pivot and start thinking frankly, at a higher level of things that of human value and human loss and what it means to be a human being. You know, very philosophical, in some ways spiritual to folks, sort of a thinking. And it's a lot to ask of a jury to have them pivot from one to the other. And for that reason, we typically will not include economics, even enormous economics, because I always tell the jury this, that, you know, we don't need you to add up medical bills with your calculator. You know, we can find somebody to do the math for us. We don't need you to do that. We have experts to do that. You know, but you, the jurors, are the experts in the things that matter the most, which is human loss and human suffering. And we've, you know, that I think that's a powerful argument that gets jurors thinking at a higher plane and in a more significant, and it's more significant way about the case than, you know, than just being, you know, human calculators. This episode of Face the Jury is brought to you by Forge Consulting. For nearly 20 years, Forge has helped victims of personal injury manage their settlements. Forge Consulting has been a big help in my legal practice. I've been working with them for, gosh, probably 10 years now, and they are always available to answer questions. They help when I have liens that need to be resolved before I can finalize a client's settlement. They have been fantastic to work with in giving advice to my clients on how to handle their money. And most importantly, they're just good people. I've worked with Corey Phillips for many years, and he is always available to answer any questions I may have. From structured settlements to managed funds and other investment vehicles, Forge Consulting has the expertise and the knowledge to help make the money last a lifetime. To learn more about how Forge Consulting can help you, visit forgeconsulting.com. Back now to John Campbell, founder of Empirical Jury. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is what you've learned about COVID. You know, there's a lot of fear among the trial bar that that COVID is going to negatively, from our perspective, impact our juries. And I believe the defense is hoping that's the case, because I see billboards around Atlanta where I practice, and they have billboards, you know, celebrating our heroes in the healthcare industry and our heroes, hero nurses, hero doctors. And I'm not taking away from the good folks who do the hard work, particularly in COVID, but there seems to be an energy to elevating the healthcare professionals into this hero status, I believe, for the cynical purpose of prejudicing juries against injured patients. Can you talk about that and what your research has revealed in that regard?
Yeah. So right in the heart of COVID, almost a year ago now, we took three previous cases, all MedMal, and we'd already run them for attorneys, and we had hard data on them. And what we did is we ran them again. And we wanted to see, we had a simple control. The exogenous shock, as we would call it, was COVID. The cases were otherwise the same case. And the question was, is it true that somehow all these MedMal cases are destroyed, as the defense was talking about, right? So you just can't win a MedMal case. You're going to get killed in MedMal cases, and you ought to take 50 cents on the dollar to settle this case because, you know, we've got the upper hand. And what I can tell you, the short story is that wasn't true. And there were a few reasons for that. One of them is for a while, it's washed out some now, there was a very interesting effect, which was that for every juror who sort of liked doctors more, there was another juror who liked them less, right? Because we have a divided country. And so interestingly, for a while, in MedMal cases, Trump supporters, who tend to be harder on damages in cases and tend to like lawsuits less as a rule, actually started to be favorable to plaintiff's attorneys in MedMal cases. And that was because, and I can give it to you in a picture. If you remember this, it made the national news when people were saying, let us out of our house, and protesting in the streets. A lot of them were in big trucks with Trump banners. And the people who stepped out in front of them to counter protest were wearing medical scrubs. And so there was this thing that happened that was very interesting during COVID, in which some of the jurors who used to just not like lawsuits and therefore said you shouldn't sue a doctor, they didn't necessarily love doctors, but they just didn't like lawsuits, actually started to say, I'm not such a big fan of the medical industry. I think some of that's hanging on. And so the answer then is some of it washes out. The other part of it, though, is to the extent there is any increased glow to doctors and nurses, I think good lawyers mostly understand that in most MedMal cases, unless you have egregious conduct by the doctor or nurse, beyond negligence, I think, right? Something more. The case is typically going to be focused more on the institution than the doctors and nurses.
The system failures,
the doctors and nurses are victims of a hospital that failed, or a medical center that failed, or whatever. And what we see is that jurors have no sympathy for them, right? Because the hospital's who sends you a bill. Jurors are not particularly in love with the medical industry, although they may like doctors and nurses. And so for all those reasons, I don't think it's harder to win a MedMal case now than it was pre-COVID. I don't think the values have changed dramatically, but it probably has, if anything, given us a reminder that in every case we should be asking, can we talk about the system and the system failure before we ever talk about an individual healthcare provider?
Well, and that seems to be the natural evolution of medical malpractice cases. As you know, I do almost exclusively medical malpractice work. And in Georgia, I know this is true in other states, we're seeing sort of a Game of Thrones reality in healthcare, where you have these big healthcare empires, enormous healthcare companies gobbling up the smaller independent practices. I mean, it's almost universal. And anybody, my father was a physician and had a small medical practice, general practice outside of Atlanta. And those things are just gone. I mean, first came the doc in the boxes, which were corporatized independent care. And then now you have these big companies. So there's a reason for doing it. I mean, these big healthcare companies want to gobble up these smaller practitioners and funnel them into their system because that represents revenue streams. It represents referrals and high value patients that bring a lot of resources that the government will reimburse, primarily through Medicare and even private insurance. So there's this sort of economic forces at play. And you touched on a couple of things I want to comment on. that there is such division in this country politically. You know, this is not a spoiler alert for anybody listening to this, that we are a highly divided country. But we as trial lawyers don't have the luxury of just picking jurors who might align with our personal value set and our personal politics. We have to speak to the universal values of all our jurors if we want to be successful. And I think that involves aligning the values of our case, the values that will speak to the more conservative jurors, which might be values such as personal responsibility, respect for authority, the sanctity of life, if that's if you're dealing with a wrongful death case, a person's right to life, you know, those types of values. If you're speaking to your more left-leaning jurors, you might speak stronger on issues of justice and equity. And you've got to find the universal values in your case that will speak to both sides of the spectrum. Because if you're just speaking to one side or the other, you're in trouble. I tried a case about a month ago, my first post-COVID case. And it's a medical malpractice case, but it's on one single factual issue, an issue involving whether the defendant doctor and his previous lawyers committed fraud and hid a key medical record. And that was the only issue. And then and the outcome of that trial will feed into the next final trial, which will be the full medical case. And we were a few days in, we got into trial, and the defense lawyer asked an interesting question of the jury I'd like you to comment on. He asked the jury, "Where do you get your news from? What's your primary news outlet?" And at first, my reaction was, "Hey, that's a pretty good question. This will quickly reveal if somebody's on the left or the right." Is the way I was thinking. If somebody's a Fox News person, then you know that's obviously one category. If they're an MSNBC person, that's and quickly you'll know where people line up on the left and right. Well, there's a lot of resistance to that question. I noticed it. People were uncomfortable answering it because they knew exactly what he was asking. He might as well have just asked, you know, who's a Republican, who's a Democrat, or an independent. And there was resistance to it. And I felt that there was some negative feeling that they directed towards the defense lawyer. And then people got resistant. A couple people were like, "I listen to Fox and CNN, you know, just like, you know, screw you. I'm not going to tell you." That's kind of how I took it. But comment on that, if you would, a little bit. That specific question, and then how to deal and what your data is showing, how lawyers can speak to jurors on the different political spectrum.
Yeah. Well, so the question itself, you're right. Your first instinct, like, "Hey, that's probably a useful question," is right in the sense that that information is often predictive. So we ask that question in surveys, and we see that often where people get their news, or people who say, "I don't consume the news at all," for example, sometimes that's predictive of how they act in a case. But the challenge you're identifying is sort of taking predictive data and taking it to the real world where you have to get it. And there's two problems there. One is maybe you'll get it, but the jurors will be mad at you for asking, which isn't great. The other is that you either get people who won't tell you, or I think worse, you get people who lie to you. And that's dangerous because, you know, somebody who really wants to make your jury but is a tort reformer, they're smart enough to know they're not going to say Fox News. They're just not going to say it. And so my view is if you're going to ask a question like that, it ought to be on a questionnaire because that minimizes the impact of asking somebody face to face. It also makes it a little less likely, I think, that they feel like they should clam up. And so I'm a big fan of the plaintiff and defense agreeing on questionnaires and getting them to jurors, both for efficiency, but because it also allows people to answer in a way that feels more anonymous. And I think gives us more likelihood of getting honest answers because, you know, for some people, you couldn't describe a more frightening situation than saying, "Go stand up in front of 30 strangers and talk." And that's what we ask jurors to do. And I think it's not surprising then that they don't tell us much.
Yeah, those are some really good points. And you know, jury selection is a whole nother topic for another podcast because it's such an important part of trial. I regard jury selection coupled with opening statement as the two most important parts of the trial. That's where you're going to win the case or lose the case. But 90% of the time, I like to tell people about one of my favorite authors and podcasters who talks a lot about jury selection is Sari de la Motte. I know you probably know Sari. And she's really added a lot to sort of my repertoire for jury selection, and the work she's doing is really, really solid. John, this has been great, and we're gonna wrap up here. But I want to just kind of leave with, if folks want to engage you and talk to you about bringing their case to you, first of all, what kind of case do they bring to you? I mean, we're throwing around some pretty big numbers, and I know you've worked on some huge cases. My friend Eric Fong had a tremendous result that he credits your data with, you know, having a big role. You've worked with our friend Charla and so many others. So do you have to have $100 million case to meet your threshold, or do you work on more smaller cases, more modest cases? Talk to me about that.
Yeah. The short story is that we probably, you know, to get 400 or 500 jurors has some cost. And so I always say to people, you need a very high six figure or low seven figure case probably to make it make sense. And you know, the math, to be really simple, is if somebody has a case that's worth something like $1 million, my view is, even if that case was already a slam dunk on liability when it comes to us, by who you seat, how you talk about damages, what bells you ring, what damage pictures you paint, you can add 20% or 30% in a bad day to that case. If that's the case, if you can add $200,000 or $300,000 to the verdict, it makes perfect sense to have us involved. Everybody's happy. We get paid. The attorney does better and the client does better. Below that, we don't do a lot of cases that say are less than $500,000. The exception, I would say, is that when people have sets of cases. So for example, we have some firms we work with who have nursing home cases, and any given nursing home case may only be worth $500,000 or $600,000, but they have 30 of them and they all look a lot alike. And so making sure that they're trying their very best case and winning cases increases value for all of them. And so it may make sense to get that case right, even though on that individual case, you spent quite a bit of money to get it worked up. So I think that's, you know, that's probably where we live. We work on cases all over the country. As far as type of case, we work on any type of plaintiff case because the model works for any type of case. I should say, as it's probably obvious, we don't work for defense attorneys ever. I tell everybody proudly, I've only defended one case, and it was when my class action representative got sued for her dog biting somebody. And I literally defended a dog bite case. You know what? I won. So I'm 1-0 as a defense attorney, and that's the only time I'm ever going to do it.
Don't lead with that on your website that you did defense work, but that sounds like a pretty
just that,
limited
just that
example.
Dog bite. Yeah.
Well, I know you mentioned you came up working with John Simon, who's a wonderful lawyer. It was actually the very first lawyer I met in Ireland at our first Inner Circle meeting, and didn't know hardly anybody there other than by reputation, of course. And he was the most generous guy and walked over to me and my wife and just as nice as he could be, and a phenomenal reputation and track record. But John, this has been great. And what I'd like to do is get a commitment from you to come back and do another podcast with me after we have our first successful case together. So I can share my experience and you can share yours, and we'll sort of do it before and after, since we haven't gone forward all the way with the case yet. So if you'll promise to do that, I'll let you go today and look forward to talking to you down the road.
That would, of course, be my honor and my privilege.
Well, thank you, John, and I appreciate you being here. This has been great, and I appreciate everybody joining us for this episode of Face the Jury. And we'll look forward to seeing you next time. Thank you.